Okay, why do we know that? Be seated, please. Good evening, everyone. Today, our Dhamma talk will be given by Most Venerable Kassapa Thero, Great Bhikkhu Kassapa Thero. Kassapa Thero, was ordained in the London at the London Buddhist Vihara when we were in the Heathfield Garden during the Most Venerable Sadatissa time. He was ordained there by Venerable Sadatissa Thera. And for the occasion, Most Venerable Ajahn Chah, Most Venerable Vajrarama Pedasenayaka Thera attended to that ordination ceremony. Very historic event. Ajahn Chah, you know Ajahn Chah, no need to introduce him. Ajahn Chah and Most Venerable Piyadasi there attended to that ordination ceremony. Soon after his ordination, Kassapa Thero, he was very young that time, he had gone to Sri Lanka. He loved Sri Lanka. On and off, he had been in Sri Lanka for nearly 41 years. Altogether, 21 years he had spent in Sri Lanka. He can speak Sinhalese very well. Very well he can speak Sinhalese, good Sinhalese. And also he spent in the forest in Sri Lanka. And he was very fortunate, I was told once, he was able to throw flowers from the sky over the Guamalis hair. So, he, during the wartime, you know wartime in Sri Lanka, he was invited by Sri Lankan community in the UK to speak on behalf of Sri Lankan community. Such a great patriotic monk to our country. We invited him today for the sermon. I would like to welcome him. Bohma adaring, bohma onakamin, obawanse piligannawa. Lankawata bohma hitawat, Lankawata bohma adare karana Singala bhashawen ithama hondin katha karanna puluwan. Maha Britanni Kassapa Hamdan Mahansi me ithama me nihitamani Hamdan Mahansi kene ithama vinayagaruka Hamdan Mahansi nama me dharma sankachchawata me dharma desanawata etwasenna talk ekata unwanse ta aaradhana karala labuwa ithama gauruwen unwanse pili aragena me kathawata aaradhana karana.
Devotees of London Buddhist Vihara. Today I have been invited to speak, as mentioned by the Most Venerable Srila Vimala, on the subject of samsara and nibbana. I believe, as is often the case for the benefit of those who do not know Sinhala very well in particular, I have been invited to speak in English. It doesn't really matter, because whichever language the teachings of Dhamma, the teachings of the Enlightened One, are conveyed in, these teachings are something which are and should be universal. In fact, I've heard that once the Enlightened One advised the monks, members of the Sangha, to speak, or at least attempt to convey the teachings of Dhamma in the particular language spoken by the people who were listening to those teachings on any particular occasion. This is logical, because then the tendency naturally is for various points to be absorbed more easily into the psyche. For my part, as mentioned by the Most Venerable Srila Vimala, because I went to Ceylon as a boy, actually, I became accustomed to the language, and therefore it became my other language. I'm not keen on saying second language, but it's my other language. So we are living in Great Britain, so I speak to people of this country very often, actually, on the subject of Dhamma, which is a subject which is still, in a sense, somewhat, in real terms, unfamiliar to people, in the sense that it is something strange to the Western, so-called Western, in inverted commas, psyche. And the reason for this is because the teachings of Dhamma are, in a sense, something which is the antithesis of certain aspects of Western culture. Western culture was born out of, according to the teachings of Dhamma, what we call, and which you may obviously be well familiar with, the concept of, in inverted commas, wrong view, or to be precise, erroneous view. Various beliefs which we regard as being what we call in Pali micchaditti, wrong view. This is based upon a feeling which people have deep in their subconscious, which is really becoming ingrained in people's subconscious. Worldwide, actually, since time immemorial, and which is still very, very deeply ingrained in people's psyche all over the world, there is no doubt about it. I have observed over quite a period of time the circumstances prevailing at present in Western society in relation to the teachings of Dhamma. To be realistic about it, there is progress. There is, as it were, movement, but it is very, very, very gradual indeed. I would venture to say that there is not a retrogression, which is something which is wonderful, which is to be celebrated. So there is some sort of progress. This is partly due to the fact that, on one hand, the Western psyche is always searching, is very incisive, and people are always very inquisitive and searching for the answers to everything, including, and very importantly, of course, things scientific. However, actually, it's quite curious when you look around and you see what is happening in wider society in relation to certain practices, originally Buddhist, which have, and Hindu, been, I would venture to say, poached and cherry-picked and recycled predictably for worldly ends in the West, such as, for example, two examples which spring to mind: yoga from Hinduism and mindfulness from the teachings of the Enlightened Ones. Now, predictably, in relation to practices such as yoga, people are, on the whole, inclined to focusing on their physique and keeping healthy and so on, which is also very important, and yet people become infatuated with these things. But I believe that certain sectors of Hindu society were at one point practicing yoga with more of an idea of a link with things spiritual, as something supportive of their perhaps meditative development. With this practice of mindfulness, which in recent years has been introduced into the West and has become something which is trendy and which is rather how can I say, faddish even, in inverted commas. People in wider society appear to be focusing on one aspect of it, and with, again, worldly ideas, mindfulness in itself is something which is very useful and relevant and in itself is not harmful at all, and which will be helpful to people. But the mindfulness which was declared, which was shown by the Enlightened Ones, is something far superior to this. Something far greater than this. Something far more unique than this. We call in Sinhalese Vishishtai, Paramai. Words like this are employed. Uttaritarai. This is because the Enlightened Ones talked of mindfulness and clear awareness or what we call in the Pali language, sati sampajanya. This is, very roughly speaking, mindfulness or bare awareness, which the West has adopted, such as even in Parliament, where a few years ago 86 MPs were undergoing mindfulness training, apparently, or in the Bank of England, where employees were undergoing mindfulness training, or even in the US military, where soldiers apparently were undergoing mindfulness training, that is, snipers in the US military. But this is mindfulness and clear comprehension. This is mindfulness based on wisdom. This teaching of wisdom is something which is utterly unique to the teachings of the enlightened ones. It is not to be found anywhere else. In a sense, one is very, in inverted commas, proud of this. In a sense, in inverted commas, proud to be a Buddhist. All beings are spinning around in a somewhat confused state in terms of their what we call samsaric condition. They are wandering from birth to birth, as was elucidated by the enlightened ones, blindly. And most beings in the world are searching, obviously, for happiness, some sort of happiness, various forms of happiness which they perceive to be happiness, in inverted commas. However, the teachings of the enlightened ones do indeed speak of worldly happiness. And the enlightened ones never proclaimed that one should not experience worldly happiness, and that one should not experience sense pleasure. And yet, unlike the prevailing perception in the West, in particular, that amongst some people in particular, this kind of happiness is what should be pursued, the enlightened ones talk of a far more sublime, a far more subtle, a far more rare happiness. That is the happiness of Nibbana in the Pali language, or Nirvana in Sanskrit, or Nirvana in Sinhalese. This term, again, predictably has been corrupted in the West, grossly corrupted. And actually, I often speak to Western people mentioning this and explaining this. In fact, virtually every week I try to clarify these things, just so that eventually, possibly, certain ideas might seep into society to counteract certain wrong perceptions which have been created due to the ignorance of people, in particular in the West, who have misunderstood these concepts due to a lack of understanding of the true teachings, in this case of the enlightened ones. This concept of Nirvana It's something, again, which is utterly unique to the teachings of the enlightened ones, and which I do not compare with any other kind of happiness. This happiness has a number of unique aspects. One of them is that, as you may well know, this happiness potentially can be experienced right here and now within, as the enlightened ones said, this fathom-long body, that is, 6 feet, roughly 6 feet long body, right here and now, actually, or some degree of it. So, this is an aspiration which is entirely practicable for us. In fact, I sometimes recall my own experiences. Basically, as a boy, I became a Buddhist at age 13, purely out of my own wish, actually. At the time, my mother had been practicing a form of Hindu meditation with a view to curing an illness which she had suffered from about 30 years of epilepsy. And after a certain point, my attention became distracted, for example, from studies. At primary school, apparently I was very good up to a certain point. I remember being top of the class. But then there was a change in my mind, to the extent that this was even remarked upon by my teacher at the time. When I think of this, this is something which is very significant indeed. In fact, that teacher asked me literally where I had gone to in terms of what she perceived as my mind having wandered or my attention having been distracted. So after around about age 9, I started to feel unsettled, unhappy. This, I can confidently say, was not anything that was a result of any particular family conflict or anything which we experienced at home at all. But I believe was due to a subconscious influence on my and my brother's minds as a result of my mother's illness. And I used to wonder about the nature of the world. I used to remember standing in my bedroom and staring at the wall and wondering in stages about our lives, about birth, about education, about adulthood, and then the gradual progression through old age, and then finally death, and what the meaning of all this was. Why are we born? Why are we living? Why do we die? I was wondering about this from really a spiritual standpoint. Not because of any particular intellectual knowledge that I had at all, but through a spiritually motivated feeling which I obviously had. Unlike, for example, certain scientists who are talking about, in inverted commas, the big questions. Why are we born? Why are we living? Why do we die? This is a different attitude. This is a different pursuit. They are curious about the worldly scientific aspects of our existence. But here I was concerned with the feeling of suffering and unsatisfactoriness which I had felt in myself. And So, by some great fortune, I truly believe, and it is clearly, I believe, evident to me in my life, through some very strong karmic force, I came into contact with Buddhism, with monks, with temples, and my initial contact actually with Buddhism and with monks and with temples was with the Thai temple. At the time it was not in Wimbledon, this was in East Sheen at number 99 Christchurch Road, which was opened by Their Majesties the King and Queen of Thailand in 1966. And my mother had suggested that I come along with her and try some meditation, try some Hindu meditation system. And she explained something about what this was, but for some strange reason, I was not attracted to that. And I had seen Buddhist monks on television at the time, actually Mahayana monks, Shaolin monks, meditating and practicing martial arts and so on. And we had a book at home with some information on the various religions of the world, and I came to understand that these monks whom I saw on the television were Mahayana monks, being Shaolin monks. So I thought, being a boy of 13 years old, that this was the thing for me, and I asked my mother to find a temple which was nearby. So she looked in the telephone directory and found the nearest temple and sent me to that temple. And it happened to be the old Thai temple in East Sheen, Christchurch Road. So I went along there, and I was ushered inside, and I saw the saffron robes, smelt the incense, and so on. And I was ushered inside by the deputy senior incumbent. I was sat down on a comfortable sofa, and he sat down, and we had a chat. And at the time, I also had a desire to also learn martial arts to some degree, which admittedly could be construed as being a worldly idea. I had a friend at school who had taught me some martial arts as well. So, when I asked about this, the monk concerned smiled and said, or even chuckled, saying, "Here, we do not tend to the body, we tend to the mind." So I felt some slight degree of disappointment, as I was a boy of 13, and I thought perhaps this was not the place for me. However, I was attracted by the atmosphere in that place. And there were various charismatic vibrations, such as the sight of the monk's robes, for example, and the smell of the incense, and so on. And I participated in the devotional activities and the meditation with the monks. And I saw literature on Buddhism, very similar to the literature which is on display at the front of the London Buddhist Vihara right now. Basic books on Buddhism. At the time, of course, there was far less available. But what was available actually was literature which has now become iconic and which happens to be very good, very lucid, and very comprehensive, such as books like what the Buddha taught by the most venerable Walpola Rahula, and the Buddha's ancient path by the Venerable Piyadasi, the late Venerable Piyadasi Nayakathera, and the word of the Buddha by the late German Mahathera, senior elder Venerable Jnanatiloka, and Venerable Narada, the Buddha and his teachings, and so on. And I picked up these books, and I remember reading certain paragraphs in these books, reading about the life of the Enlightened One. I had not really heard or known anything specific about the teachings of Buddhism or the Enlightened One before that, actually. Though I saw the Shaolin monks on television, I did not really have any understanding at all. And I remember reading one or two paragraphs in one of the books about the life of the Bodhisattva and the life of the fully enlightened one subsequent to his realization of full enlightenment, wandering the highways and byways of northern India, having realized the universal truth, and having left his palace, having made the great sacrifice, and having undertaken such great austerities for such a long period of time, and then, out of great compassion, as said, wandering the highways and byways of northern India at the time, like a bird, really, free as a bird, proclaiming the path to enlightenment, to happiness, to the realization of the truth that he had realized to humanity. That is, the doctrine that he had realized. The Four Noble Truths and Noble Eightfold Path, being the fourth truth as it is, and the three characteristics of existence, and so on. And I remember thinking clearly to myself, this is something which is relevant to me. This is a practical path. This is something which really appeals to me. This must, in retrospect, have appealed to the deep levels of my subconscious, because I felt some sort of security upon reading these teachings in a way which I had never felt, to be perfectly frank, during school assemblies when hymns and prayers had been recited, for example, which we did not really understand anyway, but were really something more to be believed. One felt a certain kind of comfort of sorts in hearing certain lovely hymns and so on, but here I felt a deeper sense of security, I would say, which was based on something truly substantial, something solid and substantial. I wanted the answer to my problem, really. I wanted to find the answer to the problem of suffering and unsatisfactoriness. That is all I wanted. When I think back, that was a very innocent thing to have wanted. That is the most fundamental thing that people wish for in this world, in this universe, what all beings, in fact, ranging from deities through human beings down to the most minuscule beings such as insects and so on. This is what all beings aspire to happiness. The question is, the big question is, the big question mark lies with the method in which we, by which we achieve that happiness, and the path which is followed to attain to that happiness, and the nature of that happiness also, actually. This happiness which we as Buddhists are aspiring to is the happiness of the sublime happiness of nirvana or nirvana, the coolness of the heart right here and now, which is achieved by following a very, very specific path of spiritual development, which was laid down by only the fully enlightened ones. This was laid down, this was realized or re-realized after a very, very long period of time, in this instance by the fully enlightened one, Gotama, after a very long period of time having wandered through countless existences, it is said, searching for this subtle truth. I believe that this actually happens. This is not just legend. There are reasons for this. All this is logical. All this is perfectly plain when you think about it. It is possible, in my view, that considering in terms of the latest revelations of modern science, for example, that the cosmos is indeed infinite. In fact, the enlightened ones declared that no beginning or end of the universe is to be known. It is actually true. And, therefore, logically, we may believe that now, somewhere in other, perhaps, universes, and I stress here that actually I do not know. This is an idea in my mind. But it is possible that if, as modern scientists believe, there are what we call multi-universes, that even now in other universes there are beings who are searching for that ultimate truth in similar ways, wandering from birth to birth. But the journey that such beings embark upon and have to travel along over an immense period of time is fraught with many, many obstacles, which is indeed an understatement, and a process of trial and error, culminating in the liberation from samsara and the realization of nirvana. That is the freedom from the shackles of samsara, or this process of wandering from birth to birth as a result of non-understanding of the truth of the way things are, or, to put it bluntly, ignorance. The liberation from this and the development of wisdom, the perception, the realization of the truth of the way things are, that is, in particular, the three characteristics of existence, and in particular, the heart of it, that is, the realization of impermanence, through which the heart is ultimately liberated, culminating in the realization of nirvana over a long, long, long period of time. Now, this is perfectly possible and, I believe, is absolutely true. And why is this so? Why is it that the bodhisattvas have to wander for such a long period of time to realize this? The reason is because this truth that the enlightened ones realize is extremely subtle, and which is not immediately evident to the vast majority of beings in this world. Actually, in a sense, this is rather strange in one sense, because actually the truth is right in front of us, right here and now. In fact, to sum it up, people are missing, beings are missing the wood for the trees, as the old English saying goes. The truth is closer to us than we may think. But the nature of the forces which are perpetuating this process of being, and which are propelling this process of samsara on and on and on, the forces, that is, in particular, the forces of ignorance and craving, the resultant generation of craving, this leads beings to look far outside themselves for answers. A case in point is what the vast majority of scientists are doing, including such geniuses such as Einstein and Professor Hawking, and even young scientists such as, relatively young scientists such as Professor Brian Cox and so on. They are looking outside themselves for the nature of reality, but the nature of the reality that we are seeking is something which is closer to home, as said, than one might think. That is, the ultimate truth. The ultimate truth has been described in various ways over the centuries and over the millennia. One concept which I believe, though who am I to say, I'm not a scholar, and yet I believe, I may be mistaken, but it is my personal feeling that a certain concept has possibly been misunderstood over a long period of time and even distorted as a result. And that is the concept of sunyata, or emptiness. It may be amongst certain so-called Buddhists, particularly of certain traditions, that there is a belief that there is an attainment to some state of emptiness. This may be a belief prevalent among some. Well, there is such a state of emptiness, but that state of emptiness is not what we are aspiring to. And there is a very important and subtle reason for this. This state of emptiness is one of the 16 very subtle and lofty states of consciousness known as the Brahma worlds. But the emptiness which the enlightened ones were talking of, which were speaking, the enlightened ones were speaking of in relation to the nature of ultimate reality was a reference to the emptiness of existence in terms of insubstantiality as a result of all things being subject to impermanence. All things are impermanent. The entire thing is an utter illusion. But there are two types of reality. This is something which, again, I speak of when, in particular, I speak to Western people, which I feel is quite necessary in order to guide them towards the subtlety of the teachings of the Enlightened Ones. There is a conventional reality. There is also an ultimate reality. We function within the boundaries, obviously, of conventional reality from day to day. We must continue to do so in order to function. But this reality is something which was declared by the Enlightened Ones to be in actuality, in terms of ultimate truth, an utter illusion. In fact, as an example, as you may well have heard, to give an example of all, according to scientists, things which it is possible to see within the spectrum of the visible world, the human eye can only see 5% of it. So we can't even see, according to those scientists, about 95% of what is actually physically present. And yet we sort of conjure up all sorts of notions about the world. We sort of, in inverted commas, cook up all sorts of notions, illusions about the world. But further to this, in terms of ultimate reality, also, the entire thing is an illusion, because the entire world is something which was declared by the Enlightened Ones to be something which we have created. Beings have created this, in inverted commas, world. And this is a process which is spinning on, and which was referred to by the Enlightened Ones as samsara, or in Sinhalese, sasara. This process of spinning on, the process of being, in inverted commas, this being, that, now here and now there, this constant process which churns on ad infinitum until we come to a point by some good fortune in the sense of actually our karmic destiny, that is karmic destiny, to encounter the true teachings and therefore the exit from the entire process. And this is something which happens over a long, 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 long period of time. For the Enlightened Ones, as previously mentioned, it takes far, far, far longer. This is why it is said that it takes literally aeons of time for the bodhisattvas to develop to that point. And the culmination of that process is truly, truly extraordinary. The fully enlightened ones are truly, truly extraordinary beings. It actually happens. They actually lived. They actually appear from time to time in this world. It is the same as the manifestation of deities which the enlightened ones have spoken of, which Westerners on the whole would be very skeptical of, but which actually exist when you actually see them with your own eyes, such as in places like the shrines of ancient Ceylon, which I have paid homage at in many places and personally seen many things myself. Then you are struck by the wonder of the teachings of the enlightened ones and the nature of reality. The nature of reality itself, of ultimate truth, is indeed very, very strange, and arguably even stranger than scientific doctrines like quantum mechanics. And there is a reason for this. The reason is because it is something which is closer to home than we might have thought, and which is something which will lead to surprise on the part of the vast majority of beings, because the perception usually is that the universe is a very, very complex place, which in a sense it is indeed in terms of conventional reality. But in terms of ultimate reality, it in a sense becomes far more simplified. We come to understand what is happening here, and that ultimately the entire world, in inverted commas, is actually a thought. The whole thing, arguably, appears to me, though I may be mistaken, to be an evolution of sorts from ignorance to, or nescience to, science. That is science with a capital S. That is science based upon wisdom. That is wisdom, knowledge, true understanding of the truth of the way things are. Why this process happens, I cannot say. In fact, the enlightened ones have advised beings not to think too deeply on certain subjects, saying that it leads to madness, such as the nature of nirvana, the nature of jhana, the states of concentration, the knowledge of the Buddhas, and there is one more which does not come to mind at this moment, as far as I recall. And it is actually true. It is actually true. How could there be a beginning or end to the universe? According to the teachings of the enlightened ones, how could there be? It is actually logical that there is not. And why is this? Because the enlightened ones declared, upon realization of full enlightenment, something which is astoundingly profound and deep, and which is the arguably backbone, in a sense, of that supreme realization which the fully enlightened ones arrive at. And that is the law of dependent origination. The law of what is called in Pali, paticca-samuppada. The fact that all things are conditioned, dependent upon conditions. This is something which we focus on in the realm of meditation practice, and it is because of the law of impermanence and because of the law of conditionality that this world, in inverted commas, is ultimately unsatisfactory. I do emphasize to Western people that the choice is there as to whether one wishes to pursue this path to develop one's understanding beyond a certain point or not. Because potentially, certain realizations about the nature of reality could lead to a state of being severely unsettled. But I do emphasize, as said, that there is a conventional reality and there is an ultimate reality. And in terms of conventional reality, yes, everything exists. We must continue with our lives, with our family lives, with our professions and everything else. And yet, what the fully enlightened ones offered out of their great compassion to the world, to all beings, was an exit from this endless process. An exit from the process of samsara, or the wandering from birth to birth, the constant wandering, an exit, like an exit on a motorway of sorts, which you suddenly exit, if you want to. And we enter into a sublimely peaceful and happy grove, which is cool, that is the happiness of Nirvana, this unique happiness. This happiness which is not dependent upon any outside source. This is the key point here about the uniqueness of the happiness of Nirvana. All these types of happiness which are being talked about by various people who adhere to various doctrines, various views and opinions, and so on, are in things which they envision as giving heavenly happiness, heavenly satisfaction, and which are permanent. But these are things which are all dependent upon conditions, and therefore are unsatisfactory. In fact, this entire process keeps churning on because of craving due to the non-understanding of the truth of impermanence and so on. And therefore, this force is burning and is propelling things on. Until that craving is extinguished, then these forces are not extinguished, and the tendency is to crave for more and more stimulation. And the flip side of this craving is actually very destructive, and that is aversion. Attachment and aversion, which are more subtle ways of referring to the two extremes of greed and hate, attachment and aversion. When the cravings which arise for more sense stimulation by way of the six senses, by way of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind, when these are not satisfied, then a frustration arises, and what we call in Sinhalese getima, and then irritation arises. So these are all forces which are in operation as a result of habits which have, in a sense, been automatically created due to the presence of the non-understanding of the truth of the way things are, the presence of ignorance, and therefore this generation of craving for more, wanting more and more. And in some cases, this can lead to deep unhappiness. In the past, I have spoken of the case of, for example, the iconic late pop star, Elvis Presley, which is a very, very clear case in point. And it is well known that Elvis Presley was a man who, after a certain point in his life, had everything. He was very, very handsome. He was a very good singer. And due to his skills as a singer and dancer and so on, he came to fame and fortune. And he became very wealthy, and he had any amount of sensory pleasure to be enjoyed at his fingertips. And yet, look what happened to Elvis Presley. Look at the life of Elvis Presley. Look at the tragic and pathetic end to his life. People like this who have everything can make a heaven of their lives, and yet due to delusion, due to greed and hate, they destroy themselves. In the case of Elvis Presley, what happened was that he became addicted to satisfying all his little cravings and having endless relationships, no doubt, and so on. And then finally this culminated in boredom. And nothing was enough. And he started eating. And he became grossly obese, grossly fat. And then he started becoming angry because he could no longer, no doubt, he could no longer perform as he had been able to. He could no longer live up to the expectations of his fans and so on. And this led to great depression and unhappiness on the part of this particular individual. This is actually what happens to certain performers. This is actually what is going on, actually, I believe. For example, two cases in point which spring to mind are the cases of two comedians, one of whom certainly apparently committed suicide, the other who was suspected of committing suicide, and that is one named Tony Hancock. The other was Kenneth Williams. Now, they were brilliant performers, and beyond a certain point, having enjoyed all the success and so on, they were no longer able to deliver in the way that they had been able to as younger men, and this led to deep depression and unhappiness, namely the arising of a great degree of aversion. It was an anticlimax with a capital A. This is what happened to Elvis Presley as well. Then Elvis Presley, for example, famously once flew into a tantrum and he smashed up about $2,000 worth of recording equipment in his home, which at the time was apparently a lot of money. So, all these people may have any amount of wealth, any amount of power, such as the sitting US president who has immense power at his fingertips, immense wealth at his fingertips, and yet is he happy in the true sense of the term? Is he in control of his mind? I don't think so at all. I severely doubt it. So we can be reassured, we can be happy that we have the ability, as Buddhists, to achieve a lasting, deep, permanent happiness right here and now if we employ the teachings of the Enlightened Ones, the path declared by the Enlightened Ones, the Noble Eightfold Path, right understanding, right thought, right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right mindfulness, right effort, right concentration, and so on. If we follow this practice and we develop restraint of the senses, restraint of the senses, this is what was lost largely, even in Western society, within a relatively very short space of time, between, say, in particular, 1960 or 62, right through the 1960s, in the Western society as well. What was not understood in the West was why the relative culture of restraint, which was present in Western society up until that point was a good thing. Why this was a good thing was not understood, and it was thrown to the wind. But actually those things are good, without people going to extremes and without attachment to things. The practice of restraint, actually, of the senses is good. For example, what happened to the culture of marriage in the West is not fully understood, even to this day, in the West. The institution of marriage, arguably, broke down to a large degree after the 1960s. But certain old traditions which are still prevalent in places like our beloved Sri Lanka are actually very wholesome, and actually, if correctly understood without clinging and blind adherence, things which lead to happiness. Because these things keep in check the forces which ultimately lead to unhappiness in the minds of beings, that is craving and aversion. And therefore, all this is something which will ultimately help to guide us on the path to liberation from samsara, or the endless wandering from birth to birth, to the happiness of nirvana, or the coolness of the extinguishment of the fires of craving within the heart, right here and right now in this moment. There is nowhere to go. There is, in a sense, nothing to do. There is nowhere to go. The enlightened ones declared that we can experience this happiness right here and now within our own hearts. So, what could be more practical a path than that? What could be more wonderful than that? Now, I have spoken for just over 1 hour, so I think it is an opportune time for me to bring this talk to a close by wishing that, as a result of the merit, the happiness that you may have accrued from listening to a sermon on the teachings of the enlightened ones, and hopefully as a result of the happiness potentially which you may experience due to practicing these teachings, which must be practiced, I wish all of you and all beings the sublime happiness of liberation from all suffering. May you all be well and happy. Also.